This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in this week for Terry Gross. For 20 years, Garry Kasparov was the world's highest-ranked chess player, but he isn't playing much these days. He's become a leading opposition political figure in Russia, challenging the increasingly autocratic rule of President Vladimir Putin. Kasparov heads a coalition called Other Russia, which has staged street demonstrations and will attempt to compete in presidential elections planned for next March, with Kasparov as their candidate. Putin can't run for a third term, but is expected to play a major role in picking his successor. Kasparov also has a new book called How Life Imitates Chess, Making the Right Moves from the Board to the Boardroom. Well, Garry Kasparov, welcome to Fresh Air. Apart from the murders of politicians and journalists which have occurred in Russia, which many attribute to President Putin, tell me, what has Putin done to change the rules of government to centralize power in the presidency?
Putin continued very much the trend that was formed at the last years of President Yeltsin. Russia never experienced a real democracy or market economy, and we had some democratic institutions, rather flawed and inefficient, but they could serve as the foundation for the future. But unfortunately, last years of Yeltsin were marked by the negative process of strengthening bureaucracy and security services and making government decisions less transparent. But while Yeltsin was in power, the freedom of press and other important elements of democracy were intact, because Yeltsin owed his power to the street, to the protest, mass protest, and he couldn't or he didn't want to depart from some basic democratic rules. While Putin had to make inevitable choice between transparency of democratic institutions and a veiled system of Byzantine palace intrigues. And obviously Putin's background, a KGB background, dictated him the only choice to ruin democratic institutions and to fix Russia as the strange mixture of a medieval state with mafia-like elements and with very powerful, all-powerful, uncontrolled bureaucracy. And that was a very steady process. And for 7 years, Putin, with support of the ruling elite in Russia, and of course with the support of this enormously high oil prices that gave him an upper hand, Putin has been tirelessly working on destroying democracy and building up a police state.
Now, is it true that certain government officials, such as governors and mayors, which had been elected, are now appointed by the central government?
Yes, absolutely, yes. I don't want to count all Putin's decrees that violated constitution. I just want to emphasize it was a very steady process. And also there are a lot of rules that turned election process in a complete mockery, because now Kremlin controls virtually every element of the election process, from the registration of the political parties to the final day of counting the ballots, and no one can interfere.
So elections are scheduled for next March. You don't believe that there will be a election where votes are freely cast and fairly counted?
Yeah, but it was already a problem even under Yeltsin. All elections under Putin were getting worse and worse, so the trend is very negative. And now in Russia, unlike in America, where you have problems with the third-party candidates registered, we have the same problems with the second-party candidates. The entire process of the elections is under firm control of Kremlin, which is also a player in this game. And now it's a complete mockery, staged to keep the flavor of democracy, which Putin needs very much, not to be casted as a dictator.
So if you want to run, not so easy to get registered, not so easy to get
it's
on the
not
ballot.
So right. Easy. Right. It's, okay. It's not about not so easy. It's impossible. For
impossible.
Instance, if you want to be an independent candidate to run for president, apart many other obstacles, there is one which you cannot even technically override. You need to collect 2 million signatures. You have 2 months less than 2 months, in fact. First 2 weeks of January you can exclude because it's holidays in Russia. But most important thing that you cannot collect 2 million signatures from the regions you pick up. So, for instance, Moscow is 10 million people, St. Petersburg is 6 million. Each region can donate only 40,000 signatures. So you can have 40,000 from Moscow, 40,000 from St. Petersburg, but then you need 40,000 at least from 50 other regions, but some of them are less than 1 million people. And the Central Election Committee is empowered by Putin's rules to reject your signatures, and if they call 10% or more false, you're out of the game.
Now, what about the state of journalism? As an opposition figure, what access do you have to television and newspapers?
Television, none. Newspapers, highly limited. Radio, one radio station, Echo of Moscow, is a free radio station that offers us a chance to speak to sizable, but again, sizable by the radio standards, audience, while, of course, entire Russian population is watching Channel 1, Channel 2, Channel 3 and 4 of television, which are under strict control of Kremlin. They don't even hide the fact that they published a stop list officially distributed among TV channels, the list that includes names of the people who cannot be invited at any circumstances.
And that list includes you?
I think I'm on the top of that list.
Okay. Now there is a view that while Putin may be autocratic and brutal, he remains popular because you have a booming economy and people are, you know, have employment and better incomes. What about that view?
Well, the GDP of Russia is growing, but I think it's very dangerous in Russia to measure the success of the society by the average income. It's like measuring the average temperature in a hospital, and we understand that it's probably wrong way of assessing the success of doctors. Even if we take Moscow, which was declared by Financial Times the most expensive city for foreigners, and trust me, the prices in the center of Moscow are hitting the roof. The average income, official statistics, the average income of Moscovites per capita, monthly income, is just over $1,000. There are about 2 million people in Moscow who are living for $250 or less a month. And this is Moscow. That's really booming city. And if you travel 50 miles outside of Moscow, you could see a very different country with a falling infrastructure and even greater social inequality. Again, looking at the official statistics, you can extrapolate that 100 richest Russian families today control the amount twice as big as the entire revenue of Russian annual budget. Twice as big. But 85%, 120 million people, they're living on the other side of the fence. So that's why talking about economic success, I mean, you should remember that it affects only few, and the gap between rich and poor in Russia is growing.
As
for Putin's popularity.
Yeah. What about the polls that show him with 80%?
What polls? I mean, are you telling me that you can trust the polls in the police state? You're calling me, and you're a stranger, and you ask me about Putin. And this is a country where people still remember KGB, and they know the KGB guy runs the country. I'm surprised that 25% still saying they don't like Putin. But even if you just ignore the factor of fear, which, again, I warn you not to ignore because you're dealing not with a free country, but with a country that still remembers the communist dictatorship, people are, in general, they are not inclined to respond to the personal issues. The moment you ask the same public about economy in general, healthcare, social security, unemployment, living standards, you'll get very different picture. All approval ratings for government actions is way below 40%.
Well, Garry Kasparov, you and your opposition group held some demonstrations, I guess, earlier this year in March. Is that right? In St. Petersburg and Moscow.
We had them in last December, March, April, June. So
okay.
The largest were in March and April.
And how did the regime react to these public demonstrations?
Badly, as we expected. The regime doesn't want to see any sign of rebellion on the streets of Russia. We didn't violate any rules. We followed the regulations. We wanted to exercise our constitutional rights. But of course, any mass protest on Russian streets creates a negative psychological trend for the regime because Putin wants people to live under fear.
So were you attacked with tear gas?
Oh yeah,
and clubs
they yeah, they always try to outnumber us by the special police forces brought from all over the country. And some people say, why 5,000 demonstrators are facing 10,000 strong police units, special troops, in fact, brought from all over the country? It's because they want us to stop doing it. They want people to live under fear. And, of course, they use all sorts of legal pretexts to arrest demonstrators. I was also under arrest for 12 hours, and it was just, you know, it's a staged mockery in the courtroom where I was accused for doing something that, I didn't do.
Does your group face surveillance? Do you believe your phones are tapped? Are your meetings infiltrated?
It's not about beliefs. I mean, this is no one even is hiding. You know, it's just they follow us. The telephones are tapped. So it's a reality of Russia. It's a police state. It's maybe hard for Americans to imagine that one of the members of the exclusive Democratic Club, a friend of President Bush called Vladimir Putin, is running the state, which is violating constitution and is spying on its own citizens and also ignores our basic constitutional rights.
This is a country in which a dozen journalists have been killed since President Putin took power. Many opposition leaders have also been murdered. Do you fear for your own life?
Yes, I'm afraid, as many others.
May I ask, what steps do you take to protect yourself and your family?
I have bodyguards in Russia for me and for my family. I avoid eating and drinking in public places if I'm not fully aware of people who are with me at these places. I have very close life. I do not fly Aeroflot, for instance, long distance.
That's the Russian state airline?
Yeah. It's a very, very nicely run airline now, but I can't afford taking risk of consuming any food or liquid from the hands of people I do not know. And that's it. I can minimize the risk. But if I want to be the leader of the opposition, I can be seen as trying to eliminate the risk, which is taken by thousands and thousands of our activists throughout the country. And these brave people do not have even the minimal protection I enjoy. There's no protection of the famous name, no money to hire bodyguards or lawyers.
Well, you mentioned the famous name. I was going to ask you, do you think that your celebrity protects you in some way?
It offers some protection, but again, some. And every day, the opposition to Putin is growing. The layer of protection of my name is getting thinner.
Now, your group, which is labeled the Other Russia, is a coalition of quite diverse political points of view, right?
Yes.
Edward Limonov, who's an eccentric character to say the least, heads the new Bolshevik movement. He's a part of it, right? As well as Mikhail Kazyanov, right? A former prime minister who is very pro-capitalist. How do you maintain a coalition with such diverse views?
Now, the coalition's always created to concentrate on one or very few important items in the political agenda. In Russia today, it's about restoring democracy and organizing free and fair elections and giving opportunity for different political groups to speak out, to have access to the mass media. So it's about bringing Russia back to democracy. No doubt that in this free political environment, the groups that are now part of the Other Russia will express different views and will be confronting each other in the parliament. But today, we are facing the common enemy. It's a normal process of agreeing on the most important elements of the current political agenda. And I think that the Other Russia is doing a very important work for improving Russian political climate, because in Russia, there was very little, if any, tradition of opposing political groups cooperating with each other. We don't want to fight. We want to find common ground. If we disagree on 9 points, we're looking for the 10th one. And again, Putin did a good job by convincing Russian public that free and fair elections and democracy, the values of liberal democracy, is the only successful foundation for the modern state.
You're well known outside of Russia because of your days as a chess master, and you speak at groups in the United States. What do you and your compatriots in the Other Russia movement seek from the West, from the United States, from its government and its people?
No, not much. We just want the United States and Europe to state the obvious. If Putin acts like Chavez or Mugabe or Lukashenko, a Belarusian dictator, he should be treated the same way. United States and Europe doing a lot of business with China. But no one is trying to pretend that Chinese communist leaders are Democrats. Offering Putin free of charge, credentials of a Democrat. That's what Bush did from the very beginning, and that's what the notion that was supported by other European leaders helped Putin to create a democratic aura in Russia, which worked against us. Because when we criticized Putin for his dismal record of destroying democracy in Russia, Kremlin propaganda always referred to the pictures with Bush and Blair and Berlusconi and Schroeder, pointing out that these are the leaders of the free world and they supported Putin. So how could you listen to the marginal groups in Russia that are trying to challenge the record of our president?
You know, your interest in activism in politics predates President Putin. I mean, you were, you know, active really throughout the 1990s when Gorbachev and Yeltsin were active. And I'm wondering, what motivated you to get into politics? I mean, you were such a successful, you know, chess champion. Some people in other endeavors stay out of politics. You chose to wade right in. Why?
The chess world champion was quite a special figure in the Soviet Union. Chess was always seen as a very important ideological tool used by communist propaganda to prove the superiority of the Soviet state over decadent West. And that's why entering this epic battle against Anatoly Karpov, my predecessor at the Chess Olympus, who was supported all the time, supported by Soviet officials, I had to learn political moves as well as the moves at the chessboard. Also, my matches with Karpov were coincided with Gorbachev's rise in power and changes in the Soviet system. And for millions and millions of Soviets, I was seen as a symbol of change because I was beating Karpov. It's every year, so we played in 84, 85, 86, 87. At the same time, the Soviet system was getting more open and freer. And I sense that staying away from the political movement at the late 80s, where Soviet people had to decide their future, would be wrong, because if the world champion stays away, that's a wrong signal. So I always wanted to be with my people. I always wanted to be in the places where I could make the difference. And I jumped in and out of the politics because I didn't want to drop chess. But I also sense that in situations like in 1990-91, I couldn't stay neutral. For instance, in 1990, I played Anatoly Karpov. It was our last fifth match. We played it half in New York, half in Lyon, France. And I was the first player from the Soviet Union who refused to play under the Soviet flag and demanded to have Russian flag instead.
You know, you're also, of course, widely known in the West for your famous matches with the IBM chess computer Deep Blue in 1996 and 1997. I mean, you beat the computer in matches in Philadelphia, right, in 96, and then there was a rematch in 97. And, you know, it's interesting, in the book you described this, and you had a suspicion then that the computer might have been assisted by humans from IBM,
yes,
that there was some cheating.
What? I have suspicions even now. I believe IBM was cheating. So what? It's I say, they say. It's unless you can run scientific tests, you can't prove who is right, who is wrong. And I know that I sounded like a sore loser, but I wanted to play another match with IBM, with a computer being carefully guarded by outside scientists. They decided against it and dismantled the machine, which I called killing the only impartial witness. It's very difficult now to assess whether my claims were true or not. But when we analyze these games with modern computers that are doing better than Deep Blue, you can figure out that average performance of these machines in these games, you go through these games, is better than Deep Blue's in 96-97. But the moment you reach these crucial moves, suddenly you see that Deep Blue showed great insights that cannot be matched even by the machines that are more sophisticated. And in my view, it was also matched with a very long thinking period, again, highly unusual for the machine. So there was another piece of inconsistency. And we didn't see the printouts, because only having printouts could help you to analyze the nature of this decision, a highly suspicious decision made by the computer.
The printouts, meaning the printouts of some of its calculations.
Yes,
printouts, not the moves, right.
Yes, shows how machine makes the decision. And I suspect that what's happened is that the human expertise was used to cut the main log.
Your book is about how strategic thinking in chess can assist you in all kinds of ways. This may be an unfair question, but can you think in this chess match you're in now with Vladimir Putin, can you think of a move you've made over the last couple of years that you think you wouldn't have made if you hadn't had the benefit of all of the experience with chess?
I guess my experience with chess helped me to identify the possibilities. I analyzed the situation. I understand I should be objective. I learned from the game of chess that if you do not have sufficient material, you cannot attack. So the best strategy for us in Russia today is a tactic of survival. We don't have the luxury of making long-term plans. We do not have enough material resources. Every day we survive, we reach out more people, and we expand a little bit the territory that the other Russia control. So I always apply my knowledge from the game of chess, but it's not, you know, specific chess knowledge. I'm not looking at Putin as a chess piece or the other Russia as another piece. It's experience of making decisions and analyzing the nature of the decisions.
Well, Garry Kasparov, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Garry Kasparov's opposition coalition hopes to compete in elections next March. His new book is Life Imitates Chess. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Casey Affleck has appeared in 22 films over the past dozen years, but he's often been referred to as the other Affleck, a reference to his older brother Ben Affleck. But that may be changing now, thanks in part to Casey Affleck's starring roles in two recent films, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford and Gone Baby Gone. Both performances have won critical praise. Among Casey Affleck's other films are To Die For, Good Will Hunting, Jerry, and Ocean's 11, 12, and 13. Gone Baby Gone is the directorial debut of Ben Affleck. It's based on a novel by Dennis Lehane, who also wrote Mystic River. Casey Affleck plays a small-time detective who's asked to help find the abducted child of a drug-using mother, played here by Amy Ryan.
I just want my daughter back. I swear to God, I want to use no drugs no more. I won't even go out if you drink across my eye.
It's all right. We're gonna find her, Ellie.
You have to. You promise?
Yeah. I'm gonna try. I will.
Promise. You have to promise me.
I promise.
Gone Baby Gone is set in Boston, where Casey and Ben Affleck grew up. Well, Casey Affleck, welcome to Fresh Air. When you had to craft this character, this private eye from this working class neighborhood of Dorchester, were there people that you knew that you grew up with that you sort of drew on to craft this character?
Well, in different ways, yes. No, there was not one single person, but I knew the accent. I knew the way that people dressed and kind of what music they listened to, what kind of jobs they had, what their attitudes were towards everything from police to themselves to their children to I knew what kind of slang that they used. You know, it's just as an actor, it just means that you don't have to go spend, 4 months listening to a dialect coach and trying to get the accent right and sort of wandering, you know, getting to know people there just to figure out, like, when they wear their sweats and when they put on their, like, ironed, jeans. So those kind of things, which might not even register to kind of most people, as authentic or interesting or not authentic, you know, that people don't even really pay attention to, they did mean a lot to me. Just because I knew them, you know, I sort of knew, and I've always been really interested in those kinds of things. I guess that's probably what I like about acting, is kind of thinking about the smallest things.
Boston is a character in the, you know, Dennis Lehane's novels, and it's clearly a character in this film, and I think really evocatively drawn out by, you know, by your brother as the director. Were there moments in the dialogue and scenes that you kind of felt like, yeah, this is really what I know. This is so familiar to me.
Well, I mean, just about all of it, except for the police work. You know, anytime we were shooting kind of in the neighborhood where the character lived, and with people, you know, there's a scene in a bar, and we go in there to talk to, we're looking for this missing girl, and this is a place where the mother hung out. And so we go in there to talk to people and find out, you know, see if we can get some information. And it's the middle of the day, and there's about 6 or 7 guys, you know, alcoholics, you know, kind of sitting there in the middle of the day, you know, and it's the kind of place where my father worked when I was a kid as a bartender. It's the kind of place where, I actually spent some time as a kid, and so all of those kinds of locations and were definitely, to me, felt very authentic. They kind of rang true. They felt very familiar. It was a little bit strange. Some of them would be, you know, I'd be there and there'd be these kind of like waves of nostalgia or kind of, you know, repulsions for some reason. Yeah. And I would think, you know, I just want to get out of there or I would just want to sit there forever. And
you ever forget your acting?
Well, you try to do that every single time. But, yeah, it helped. The way that Ben kind of set up some of these scenes definitely helped because, you know, we went into that bar, for example, and when Ben was scouting the location, he went there in the middle of the day and there were six or seven guys sitting around the bar. And he said, okay, all of you, I want you to just be here, you know, and next week on Monday and you're going to be in the movie. They kind of all shrugged their shoulders and they you know, we showed up next week and there they were, you know, still sitting there in their stools and probably hadn't left. And so they ended up in the movie.
Did they have speaking roles or were they just extras?
Some of them had speaking roles.
Wow. You know, you know the director of this film very well. He's your brother, Ben Affleck. And he happened to be on Fresh Air right after you finished shooting this. And we asked him about what it was like directing you, his brother. And I thought we'd maybe just listen to what he told Terry Gross about directing you in the film.
It was really interesting. You know, it was kind of it's hard because you have to put on a different hat. You know what I mean? You can't have this conversation with your brother the way you'd have it with your brother if he's an actor in your movie. You have to treat him as you would treat an actor in the movie, which sometimes means, I mean, something as simple as trying to swallow the urge to strangle him, you know, or to be really curt with, like, just because I said to do it that way, that's why, you know, and instead of going like, well, okay, that's interesting. I hear you. Let's process what you're talking about. So it was an exercise in self-discipline. But, you know, my brother, the thing that's really rewarding is that he's a really, really good actor, and he's typically been seen in, you know, kind of character roles as well. So I think, you know, I have the good fortune of being able to show an audience something kind of new and surprising that's also really good, and that's a rarity.
And that's Ben Affleck speaking with Terry Gross, talking about directing our guest, his brother, Casey Affleck. Well, Casey, now we have to turn to you. What was it like from your end?
Well, let me just tell you, first of all, he rarely swallowed the urge to strangle him. If he felt that urge, he usually went for it. And what's more is I don't think I ever heard him say, I hear you, and let me process that. It's funny characterization of how he worked. But he was, I sort of feel sort of the opposite. I don't feel like he ever had to put on a different hat. I kind of felt like, you know, a great advantage that we had was that we were kind of brothers who had this relationship for 32 years, that we kind of had every possible kind of conversation one could have. You know, I mean, I've asked for him for advice. He's come to me for advice. We've fought. We've helped each other, lied to each other, kept secrets, told the truth. And, you know, we've kind of been through it all. So there was no ground where that was unfamiliar or where we felt like I ever felt uncomfortable. Nothing felt new. I think it was just that our ability to communicate kind of frankly and with each other, and also to kind of have the shorthand where we could, if nothing else, save time. And just, you know, I knew what he was saying before he kind of got through the first sentence, and I often felt like he understood me that quickly. That was great, you know, because often there's not a lot of time on a movie. So, you know, I think that us being brothers was only ever an advantage. No feelings were hurt. No one's, you know, I never had to worry about his ego. He never had to worry about mine. And that's not always the case in a kind of actor-director relationship. So, and what's more is that, you know, on top of it all, he had a fabulous way of talking to actors, I think just because he's been an actor. So,
you know, that's interesting because, I mean, directors all have their different styles. What is his? I mean, you've worked with a lot of different directors.
I think his is kind of no fuss, you know. I think it's, I mean, it's funny to hear him say that to Terry, you know, that he had to sort of put on a different hat. It just seemed to me that his style was to be sort of, you know, just kind of who he is, to not sort of pretend to put, you know, he never got the megaphone and put on the boots and the scally cap and never did like the old director thing. Listen, pal, and I guess say all your lines and go. You know, it was he just said, you know, I think it's like this. I think you should try it like that. Or it seemed to me like it was Ben that I'd sat on a couch next to 100,000 times, watched a movie with, and talked to him about it. And, you know, he would say, like, God, I wish they'd done it like that, or they wish they'd done it like this. And I had sort of, you know, given my opinion. That's how it always felt to me. And it was very comforting to have that relationship with him and have him on the set and to know that he wasn't pretending to be anything other than what he was, because it made me feel like, oh, here's my brother, and I know that he's looking out for me and I'm looking out for him. You know, it was always just the two of us, really. We lived with just my mom mostly, and she would work, you know, until 6 o'clock, 7 to 6, and we spent a lot of time, just the two of us, growing up. So we're pretty close.
Well, you know, this was a big move for him. I mean, he's done a lot of acting, and, you know, some would say some films not maybe done as well in recent years as some of his earlier ones. And now here he is directing, and he casts his brother in a lead role in a part that, you know, in the book was really for an older person. And some might, if this hadn't worked, I wonder if he and you might have taken some criticism. Did it feel like this was sort of a risky thing, a high-stakes thing, like you really had to nail this?
Oh, God, Dave, I don't know. It's always, if you start thinking about the risks and the potential criticisms, you'll never do anything.
Right.
I mean, it's just, and I think for Ben, absolutely, he felt that way. How could he not? You know, it's first movie out, and it's first movie he's directed, and it's also, he's already kind of famous. There are a lot of people that take very, you know, cheap shots, against him, you know, in the press, and just because they're kind of bored and petty, and they think that's a good way to make a living. So, there's so many of them that I'm sure he kind of, if he wanted to, he could have, you know, he could have focused on that, and it would have been terrifying for me. I don't care, or I've trained myself to not think about it.